probably my mother, intimidate Adam. But it was more than that. He fit here. He'd fit out running around in the trails, and packing the little boy down the mountainside. For someone like me, who'd had to fight to make my own place because I didn't fit anywhere, he was... Well, the truth of the matter was that he fit me, too. Though from their sideways looks, a lot of the rather affluent diners eating there obviously didn't think so. Adam might be going casual in jeans and a t-shirt, but he still looked like he just stepped off a modeling job. I looked like I'd been hiking all day, even though I'd pulled the leaves out of my hair in the restaurant bathroom. I sighed theatrically, resting my chin on my cupped hands and bracing my elbows on the table. "You are too gorgeous, you know." I said it just loud enough that the people who'd been watching us surreptitiously could hear me. Unholy laughter lit his eyes, telling me he'd been noticing the looks we'd been getting. But his face was completely serious as he purred,
"So, am I worth what you paid for me, baby?"
I loved it when he played along with me. I sighed again, a sound that I drew up from my toes, a contented, happy sound. I'd get him back for that baby. Just see if I didn't. "Oh, yes," I told our audience. "I'll tell Jessie that she was right. Go for the sexy beast," she told me. "If you're going to shell out the money, don't settle." He threw back his head and laughed until he had to wipe tears of hilarity off his face.
"Geez, Mercy," he said, "the things you say."
Then he leaned across the table and kissed me. A while later, he pulled back, grinned at me, and sat back in his chair. I had to catch my breath before I spoke. "Best $5 I ever spent," I told him fervently. He was still laughing when he buckled his seatbelt.
"It's a good thing we don't live in Hood River," he said. "I'd never be able to show my face in that restaurant again. $5, geez."
Adam was a gentleman raised in the 50s. He tried really hard not to swear in front of women. "I thought it was pretty cool when that little old lady tried to give you a 20," I said, and set him off again.
"The thing that spooked me,"
he drove back on the highway toward our campground,
"was that woman at the table next to us who looked like she bought the whole act even after everyone else was laughing."
"Ah, creepy lady." She'd watched us both with her eyes wide and her jaw open, but still her expression managed to be blank. I was betting she was either a total psychopath or fey, which was sometimes the same thing. I could have gone closer for a good sniff. I've learned what fey smell like, but it was my honeymoon. I didn't want to know.
"I'm never going to be bored with you around," Adam told me.
The funny thing was that he sounded happy about it.
"Want to go for a run?"
Adam asked, hopping out of bed a few hours later. We'd lain down to rest after our travels. Not much resting had taken place, but I wasn't going to complain. Still, every bone in my body was jello and he wanted to go run. I said. That was the best I could do. He grinned at me.
"You can drop the act."
I waved a weak hand at him.
"I bet I catch a rabbit before you do," he said.
Oh, he meant a run. We'd gotten back to the campground about dusk, so it was full dark. Full dark meant that in the unlikely event that someone saw Adam as a werewolf, they'd think he was a dog, helped along by pack magic that lets people see what they expected to see. The magic works in broad daylight, too, but darkness helps. "Well, why didn't you say so?" I grumped at him as I vaulted off the bed. I was wearing half a t-shirt, the left half, and my socks. The other half of my shirt was on the far side of the trailer. I was going to take an hour and clean the trailer really well before we returned it to its owner, or I'd risk being embarrassed. Which reminded me. "Hey, Adam?" I dropped the half shirt on the floor and stood on one foot to take off a sock. "Who loaned us the trailer? The only people I know who could have afforded it are you, Kyle, or Samuel. Samuel would not be caught dead with something this bulky. You told me it isn't yours. Did Kyle buy it in an attempt to compromise with Warren's desire to go camping?"
"Uncle Mike."
I froze, one foot in the air. "What? He'd borrowed something from a fae?"
Adam steadied me with a hand on my shoulder.
I'm not wet behind the ears, he told me, a little bite in his voice. Uncle Mike called me and told me he'd heard I was planning on taking you camping, and didn't he have the sweetest little trailer we could take with us?
You borrowed from Uncle Mike?
Uncle Mike offered it. Now, how did he phrase that? For services already rendered. You need to either get the sock off, Mercy, or put that foot down before you fall over.
I pulled the sock off and stood on my own 2 feet.
Faye, never give you anything for nothing, I said urgently. Not even Z, and he's my friend.
The Faye do things like make you pledge your firstborn child or your life's blood for a piece of bubble gum and make it sound like a good deal at the time.
When the Faye who owns this campground called to offer it up about an hour before Uncle Mike called, I was pretty suspicious, Adam told me.
His voice had regained its usual relaxed tone, but he was irritated. I could tell by the way he stripped off his shirt. I could leave it alone, but he didn't know the Fae the way I'd come to know them.
After Uncle Mike called, he continued blandly, I knew they wanted us here for some reason. I could have refused. I had reservations in San Diego, but I thought you'd enjoy this more than a hotel, and I knew I would.
I frowned at him.
I didn't promise him anything, Adam said with exaggerated patience. You need to remember who you are now. They can't just
He stopped speaking for a moment, then swallowed his temper with an effort, and not as much effect as he probably wanted, because the bland tone deserted him entirely.
Mercy, they can't mess with you without messing with me and the whole pack, and Samuel, and Bran, and Z, and Stefan probably for that matter. I don't know what they want. Maybe they needed us to not go to San Diego. Uncle Mike mentioned San Diego specifically, though I hadn't told anyone where I was taking you. Maybe they needed us to stick closer to home. We werewolves are a potential ally against political attacks now, since we are the only other supernatural group who admits its existence to the general public. Maybe there is something here.
He waved his hands to indicate the general area upon which the trailer sat.
It could be something as easy as using us as a deterrent to another Fae who plans on destroying what Edith has built here.
Edith must be the Fae who owned the place. Of course it was a Fae who had set up this campground with its big trees and super green grass. Adam was right. I'd forgotten that if the Fae screwed with me, they were taking on the whole pack and then some. I was more than just a mechanic who fixed VWs and turned into a coyote, because I had Adam, and I had friends. What a difference a year or two could make. If he'd stopped there, I wouldn't have gotten mad. Maybe I'd even have conceded that he'd been right, and I shouldn't have worried. But he didn't leave it alone. Because Adam might be gorgeous and smart, but he wasn't perfect.
I suppose I could have driven myself crazy,
he bit out, because our peculiar bond apparently wasn't doing its thing. He didn't know that I agreed with him, that he'd won.
Or more to the point, he said, I could have let you drive both of us crazy for the past few days speculating what nefarious plot Uncle Mike has hatched up. Uncle Mike, who has proved himself to be at least a valuable ally if you don't consider him to be a friend. Or I could keep it to myself until your curiosity got the best of you and you asked, so we could at least enjoy a couple days of our honeymoon before we started worrying about what the fuck.
He was breathing harder now, and had almost let that four-letter word all the way out. I leaned forward, kissed the white line on his cheek that came out like war paint whenever he clenched his jaw, and said lightly, All you ever had to do was tell me you had it under control, dear. I batted my eyes demurely. I'm just the wife. I don't have to strain my poor weak brain worrying about the Fae because you are here to protect me. Yep, I was ticked too. He was patronizing me. I could still, however, admit when he was right. The Fae certainly weren't the ones he had to worry about. He narrowed his eyes at me.
That is not what I said. Don't put words in my mouth.
I reached around him, popped the door of the trailer open, and changed into a coyote before he finished his sentence, and I was off and running. It would take a while before he could follow, because werewolves take a lot longer to change. I suppose he could have chased after me in human form, but on 2 feet, he'd never catch me, werewolf or not. Besides that, he was naked. The campground was rendered mostly private by topography and greenery, but it wasn't completely private.
backpack magic wouldn't do anything to hide a naked man running across the campground. I took advantage of him and left before he could continue the argument.
"Do you understand what you're doing, marrying an alpha werewolf?" my mother had said a few months ago as I drove us to yet another wedding dress outlet in Portland. Who knew there were so many white dresses? Who knew there were so many horrible white dresses? The oddest thing was that it seemed like the worse the dress, the more expensive it was.
"Yes, Mom," I said, narrowly avoiding a brownish 77 LTD being driven by a grandmother who could barely see over the dash. "I've known Adam for a long time. I know just what I'm getting myself into."
As if I hadn't said anything, my mother said, "Any kind of alpha takes some serious managing. Werewolves are controlling bastards, and alpha werewolves are worse than that. If you don't watch it, you'll find that you are doing exactly what they tell you to."
There was an interesting snap in her voice, and I wondered how often Bran had gotten her to do what he wanted her to. Not as often as he wanted, I'd bet, but evidently more than she was happy about. "I know how to take care of myself." I wasn't worried. Adam was dominant, that was certainly true, but I'd more than proved to myself that I could hold my own against him if I needed to.
"I know you do," Mom said with satisfaction. "But remember, confrontations aren't productive with an alpha. You'll just lose, or worse, make him lose control."
"He won't hurt me, Mom."
"Of course not," she said. "But a man like Adam, if he loses control, he'll feel terrible. He'll worry that he might have hurt you. Making him feel horrible isn't what you want."
She paused, considered what she said, then modified it.
"Unless it's useful for him to feel horrible, of course. Mostly, though, I found that isn't productive. Men who are miserable can be unpredictable."
I wondered if my stepfather knew how lucky he was that she felt it was in her best interests that he was happy instead of miserable. Probably he did. He was a smart man. "I'm the queen of hit and run," I told her. "All the satisfaction, none of the danger."
"Good," she said. "Just make sure he doesn't turn you into the good little wife. You'd manage it for a while. You were the good little daughter in my house from the time you moved in until you went to college."
There was a little edge to her voice, as if I'd hurt her, which hadn't been my intention at all. When I'd left Bran's Pack to live with my mother and stepfather, I'd been 16, and they'd already had a family without me. No, they'd had the perfect family without me. I hadn't wanted to disturb them any more than I could help.
"But if you try that in a marriage," she continued, "the marriage will self-destruct eventually, and there will be casualties everywhere you look."
"Adam doesn't want a good little wife," I told her.
"Of course not," she said.
But she didn't know Adam that well, and I figured she was just humoring me until she kept going.
"But he was taught how to be a husband when it was assumed that his wife would be a combination cook, housekeeper, mother who would need him to provide and protect her. He knows in his head and his heart that you are an equal, but his instincts were instilled a long time ago. You are going to have to help him with that and be patient with him."
My mother would not be nearly as terrifying if she weren't right so often. So instead of sticking around to fight with Adam, I ran to let us both cool off and to let the hurt of his patronizing remarks ease so I could think. I can't be patient when I'm mad, unless I'm waiting to get back at someone, and I wasn't that mad. Not yet. I ran the first mile or so as fast as I could, then dropped down to a dog trot. I couldn't let him treat me like his first wife. I couldn't live surrounded by cotton wool. But he knew that. I trusted him. What he'd kept from me hadn't been life-threatening. He was right. The Fae would not offend the Alpha of the Columbia Basin Pack. One werewolf was a tough creature, but the real power of the werewolves lay in their packs. I could understand him wanting to make sure our honeymoon was worry-free.
Okay,
so at what point had our discussion turned into an argument that left us both angry? And left me with an ache in my chest that felt as if he'd punched me instead of snapped at me. He hadn't even worked up to a good rage, and I felt miserable. A rabbit bolted right out in front of me. I hadn't really intended on hunting, but if the stupid things want to present themselves for dinner.
With a fresh turn of speed, I gave chase. I was eating the last of the rabbit when Adam showed up in his glorious furred form. Adam is a beautiful man, and his wolf is beautiful, too. He is colored like a Siamese cat, though in bluish grays that deepen to near black. He dropped a second rabbit at my feet and lay down in front of me, nose on his paws and his ears flattened. Nothing says you're sorry like a dead bunny. I remembered his first wife. Christy had made him apologize a lot, apologize for things that were not his fault. I didn't want an apology. I wanted to know why we'd just had a fight, and I hadn't even enjoyed it. I liked to fight with Adam. He'd been mad first. I considered that. Adam got mad for three reasons. The most common, and my personal favorite, was frustration. Usually when Adam was mad at me, frustration was the spark that set him off. Adam, frustrated and angry with me, usually started with fireworks and ended in good ways with a lot of adrenaline engendered and spent along the way. The second was if anyone was trying to harm someone under his protection. We'd established that the Fae were probably not planning our deaths or even near-fatal entrapments. The third was pain, physical or otherwise. Having established that he wasn't frustrated, and neither I nor anyone else was in any danger, I must have hurt him somehow. I narrowed my eyes at him. Usually Adam was pretty straightforward. It was one of my favorite things about him. Figuring out why he'd been mad should have been a lot easier. He'd tried to protect me, and I objected. We did that all the time, and he seldom got mad unless or until I got hurt. He'd tried to make sure our wedding and honeymoon were fun. He'd thought that I'd fret about borrowing the van from Uncle Mike, but that I'd also have a better time out here than I would have in a more typical honeymoon. He'd gotten mad when he thought I was going to get mad at him for not telling me about the trailer. It was his belief that I would get mad about it that had hurt him. I wiggled my hips into a more comfortable position and tried to think like Adam. A very smart person poisoned by testosterone. First, he knew I'd get mad if he kept anything big from me, but that wouldn't hurt his feelings. And suddenly, I understood what had happened. I got up and stepped over my kill, then over his. I licked his muzzle, and then shifted back into human. "You made some assumptions," I told him. "Take a note. It usually works better if you wait until I do something stupid before getting mad at me." Adam stared at me. I couldn't tell what he was thinking. "This building a marriage is an ongoing project," I told him, "and we'll both make a lot of mistakes along the way. I did worry about borrowing the trailer, but after a half minute's thought, I knew you'd never borrow anything from any Fae without making sure you had a handle on the consequences." I blew out a huff of air. "You got mad because you thought I wouldn't trust you to know the difference. Not fair, not fair at all. Me, I keep important stuff from you all the time." I grinned at him. "But I know you're a better person than I am. Still, I think that my frailty means you don't owe me an apology for doing something I would do, so we're even as far as keeping information from me is concerned." Now it was he who narrowed his eyes at me. "Right," I said, as if he'd spoken. It was chilly in bearskin with a sundown, so I stretched out against him and let him keep me warm. "I know what I said before I took off, but I was provoked. No apologies from me or from you, but I'll take the rabbit on account. However, if you try that patronizing stuff on me again, not even a fat, juicy rabbit is going to stop the fight we'll have." Since it was unfair for me to keep being the only one who could talk, I shifted back into the coyote. And since I have a policy of accepting gifts graciously, I ate his rabbit. Besides, fighting always made me hungry, and there was no chocolate handy. He thought it was funny that I ate the second rabbit without accepting his apology, so we were okay again. I expected that we'd have a lot more fights, and mostly I looked forward to them. Life with Adam wasn't going to be boring either. We were headed back to the campsite when we found the boat. On the way out, I hadn't run right along the river. Instead, I'd followed one of the ridges that lined the gorge, avoiding the few houses and vineyards scattered here and there, and Adam had followed my trail. On the way back, though, we ran along the edge of the river. The moon was new, just a sliver in the sky, and the stars reflected in the black water. The highway on the Oregon side was always busy, and this night was no exception. Our side, the Washington side, was a lot quieter. The river was wide, the noise of the cars a distant symphony accompanying the sounds of the night. One of those sounds was made by a boat bobbing against the shore. I paused because this wasn't a place I'd have expected to find a boat. As soon as my attention was drawn to it, I could smell blood and terror, the aftermaths of battle. A glance at Adam told me he'd noticed it too. The fur along his spine was raised, though he was silent. The boat was tucked under the edge of three or four trees and accompanying brush that grew along the bank. From what I could see, and I wiggled a lot closer than Adam could, it was one of the small fishing boats, a bass boat, the kind that maybe two or three people could use to fish in. Small enough to row, though there was a small outboard motor on the back of this one. I couldn't see into the boat because of the underbrush, but I could smell a man's fear and hear him talking.
"Don't let it find me. Don't let it find me."
Over and over again, very softly, barely even a whisper. I hadn't been able to pick up his exact words until I was within a stone's throw of the boat, and I have very good hearing. The boat hitting the rocks with the gentle rise and fall of the river's waves was louder than his voice. I backed out of the brush and met Adam's eyes. Naked was going to be hard to explain, and I knew all about what those bushes were going to do with my skin. But Adam took too long to change, would be equally naked, and if whatever this man was afraid of came back, Adam the werewolf was our best defense. Maybe other people wouldn't have automatically assumed that whatever this man was afraid of would need a werewolf to fight it. There were no werewolves around here. Vampires tended to be more of an urban monster, and the Fae Reservation was an hour the other side of the Tri-Cities, 200 miles or more away from us. But the sheer magnitude of the terror he still felt made me think I wasn't being paranoid. I shifted to human. "Hey," I called, "you in the boat. Are you okay?" The man's voice didn't alter. He hadn't registered my words at all. "I think I'll have better luck reaching him from the riverside," I told Adam. "That boat's still floating. If he's as badly hurt as all the blood I'm smelling makes me think he is, it'll be easier if we're not trying to drag him through the underbrush anyway." The nearest bit of clear riverbank was about 30 feet downstream. The sun long gone, the water was icy. I stumbled on a big rock on the river bottom and made a splash when I fell. I made some noise, too. Frigid water on nice warm skin when I'm not expecting it tends to make me squeak. The man in the boat screamed. From the hoarseness of his voice, it wasn't the first time he'd screamed tonight. "It's all right," I said, regaining my feet. "You're safe." He quit screaming, but I don't think it was because he'd understood me. Sometimes fear is too big for that. So much of your being is focused on survival that anything else falls to the side. I've been there a couple of times. The rocks under my feet were sharp, but once I was waist deep, my weight didn't press me down on them quite so hard. If I'd been headed downstream instead of upstream, I could have swum instead. Adam paced back and forth unhappily on the river's edge. The trees hung over the river, and the shore curved back under them. Finding a path through the debris that had collected in the small backwater along with the boat forced me to wade in through a bunch of underwater plants I didn't see until I was in the middle of them. My eyesight is pretty darn good at night, but the river was an impenetrable black veil, and anything below the surface was hidden. I hated not seeing. Who really knew what was in the Columbia? Something brushed against my leg with a little more force than the rest of the weeds, and I let out an involuntary yip. Adam, invisible on the other side of the tree, whined. "Sorry, sorry," I told him. "I'm fine. Just caught my leg on one of those clumps of plants. I can't see a damn thing under the water. And that and this guy reeking of fear has me all hopped up. Sorry." The stupid plant was persistent. It clung to my calf as I approached the boat, resisting my half-hearted attempts to shake it loose.
The tendency of some water plants to wrap around arms and legs of unsuspecting swimmers is one of the leading causes of drowning. However, I reminded myself, I had my feet on the river bottom, so this one was only an irritant, nothing to panic about. I forgot about the plant as soon as I grabbed the side of the boat and got down to business. My eyes just barely cleared the side of the boat, so I couldn't get a good look at the wounded man. "It's okay," I told him. "We'll get you out of this." I gave an experimental tug on the boat, but I was now up to my chest in the water, and the current threatened to push me off my feet. When I pulled on the boat, it was I who moved. I shifted my grip, moving nearer to the bow. If I pulled the boat the way it was designed to move instead of sideways, it should require a lot less effort. As a last resort, I could climb in and use the motor, but the tree limbs were only a few inches above the gunwale, and I didn't really want to scrape myself up getting in the boat. I heard something and jerked my head up. Four small heads poked out of the river about a dozen yards from the boat. Otters. Great. That was just great, just what the night needed. "Otters," I told Adam, my teeth beginning to chatter with the effect of the water. "If I start screaming, it's because the otters have come to get me." He growled a low, menacing sound, and the four heads disappeared. It wasn't as reassuring as it might have been, but there were no sharp teeth fastened on any of my parts that were underwater. Not yet, anyway. The only thing grabbing me was the damned weed, which was still wrapped pretty tightly around my ankle. I had a friend who swam once with sea otters just off the California coast. She said it was an unbelievable experience. They apparently were regular comrades to the divers in the area, playful and cute. They played a little rough. Divers who swam with them regularly often had to replace their quarter-inch neoprene diving suits because otter teeth and claws are sharp. But most of the divers counted it worth the price. River otters are smaller and even cuter than their ocean-going cousins. They also have the sweet temperament of a badger with a hangover. It wouldn't have worried me much. I have sharp teeth when I want them, too. But right now I was in their environment, and not mine. I couldn't see them. Worse for me, I couldn't smell them or hear them, either. I could wait around for them to attack, or I could get the heck out of the river. I got a good grip on the nose of the boat and managed to persuade it to move out a little. 5 or 6 feet more, and I'd have it out where the river current would push it the way I wanted it to go. The man in the boat began thrashing. It took me a second to realize he wasn't just panicking. He'd gone for the pull on the engine. As the sudden roar of the engine broke the night, I grabbed onto the boat as hard as I could and let my feet leave the river bottom. The boat lurched forward, and the weed around my ankle tightened painfully, and for a second I felt as though... But no weed is that tough, and the boat jerked me out of its hold and drove about 15 feet downstream before I pulled myself into the boat. By that time he'd collapsed again, and his hand fell off the tiller just as I grabbed it. I balanced on the seat and turned the boat back to shore, where Adam paced. The man grabbed my arm, and I almost tipped the boat over before I braced against his weight. If I'd had shoes on, my feet would have slipped off the wet wood and I'd have landed on him.
"Got to get away," he said.
His skin was as dark as mine. He was Indian, too, now that I finally had a good look at him, and still his lips managed to look pale. "Got to get you to shore," I yelled at him over the noise of the engine, "before you bleed to death." There was a crunch as the bow of the boat hit the shoreline, then a mighty jerk as Adam grabbed a bowline I hadn't seen or else I'd have used it. He pulled us up and all of the way out of the water onto the bank. I managed to kill the engine because I'd already started the motion, and when the boat stopped suddenly, I used the momentum to roll all the way out of the boat and onto the ground. My other option would have been to land on the man we were trying to rescue. The drop was not far. I hit the ground with my unprotected shoulder, which was going to bruise, but mostly managed not to hurt myself. Adam came over to me. "I'm fine," I said. "Check him." He raised himself over the side of the boat to look in. I got up at the same time. Either blood loss or the shock of seeing a huge wolf with big sharp teeth had finally driven our man, who was bleeding from the remaining half of his right foot, unconscious. Adam glanced from me to him, and then bolted. In that brief glance, he told me to stay put while he went for help. Wolves communicate much more clearly than humans do in an emergency. Adam would run all out, but we were probably 5 miles or more from the campsite. It would take him 10 minutes to get there, maybe 10 more to change back to human if he pushed it. I had no idea where the nearest hospital was or how long it would take for them to get the man there. Adam would figure it out. With the sun down, the air was chilly, the river cold, and both the wounded man and I were wet and freezing, but there was nothing I could do about that at the moment. I pulled him back down in the boat and propped up the damaged foot on the wooden crossmember that doubled as a seat. The wound was just oozing blood, which seemed odd to me. Maybe the cold was useful, even if it was dangerous. I was debating the benefits of shifting into Coyote and sharing what warmth my wet fur would gain us both against trying to figure out how to get his wet shirt off and use it to bandage his foot without a knife. Both moves were likely to be useless or worse, when I heard the hum of an engine out in the water. Lights tracked over the shore and stopped on the white boat I was standing in. I waved my arms to call them into shore. There were excited voices, but I couldn't tell what they were saying because the sound of their engine drowned out the meaning. A small but much sleeker and more modern boat, complete with lights, approached us at speed. Help was here, unless these were the guys who'd sliced off the man's foot, and me, wearing nothing but Adam's dog tags. Ah, well, it couldn't be helped. My modesty wasn't worth a man's life. The boat hadn't quite beached itself when 3 men hopped into the river. One of them grabbed the bowline, and as soon as he did, the 4th man, who'd been staying the boat, cut the engine and jumped in too. Benny, Faith, and who are you gradually resolved themselves into Hank and Fred Owens, Jim Alvin, and Calvin Seeker, introduced to me by Jim Alvin, easily the oldest of them, though only Calvin qualified as young. It was only after the Owens brothers pulled out a first aid kit and started to work on the wounded man that I realized we were all, victim, me, and the 4 in the rescuing boat, Indian. Jim Alvin was in his 60s and smelled of wood smoke and old tobacco. Calvin was somewhere in his late teens or early 20s. Hank and Fred were around my age, I thought, and close enough in appearance that they might well have been twins, though Hank didn't talk at all. I don't know if I would have noticed their dog tags if I hadn't just received Adam's, but I would still have noticed that they had some sort of emergency training by the efficiency of their movements and their focus as soon as they saw Benny Jameson. Benny was the hurt man. Jim interrogated me, for all that his questions were soft-spoken and quiet, while the Owens brothers did their best to save Benny.
"No sign of anyone else?" he asked me after I told him how Adam and I had found the boat and how Adam had run back to camp to get help and left me to do what I could.
"No." I pulled the blanket they'd given me more securely around myself.
Benny woke up briefly when they started wrapping his foot with vat wrap. It sounded like it hurt. Jim sighed. "Benny's sister Faith was with him out fishing. They were supposed to be home for dinner. Julie, Benny's wife, she called Fred tonight when Benny didn't answer his phone. We were docking, but the Jamesons are good folk. We put the boat back in the water and started looking. What tribe did you say you were?"
I hadn't, in spite of the fact that they had introduced themselves that way. All of them were from the Yakima Nation, with 3 A's, though the town was spelled Y-A-K-I-M-A. The Owens brothers were Yakima. Jim Alvin was Wishram in Yakima, as was Calvin Seeker. I didn't think of myself that way. I was a walker and a mechanic, both of which served more often than not to make me separate from other people. I was Adam's mate, which connected me to him and to the pack. I was also cold and tired. It took me too long to remember. "Blackfoot," I said, then corrected myself. "Blackfeet."
"You don't know which?" asked Calvin, speaking for the first time, though he'd been watching me since they came ashore.
I'd almost forgotten I was naked until I saw his face just before I'd been tossed a woolen blanket. I supposed polite disinterest was too much to ask from everyone. 3 out of 4 wasn't bad. "I never knew my father. My mother is white. He told my mother he was from Browning, Montana," I told them. The wool was doing a good job of warming the skin it covered. naked, wrapped in a blanket among strangers didn't used to bother me. Maybe if Calvin would have quit staring at the various pieces of me that the blanket didn't cover, it still wouldn't have bothered me. As it was, I did my best to keep Jim between Calvin and me.
"So you were raised white," said Calvin in disapproving tones.
I should have told him I was Hispanic, and any Indians in my bloodlines were South American and unknown. Half of my customers thought I was Hispanic. Telling them I was Hispanic felt like it would have been less of a lie than telling them I was Indian, as if I were claiming ties that weren't there.
"Browning, Montana makes him Blackfeet," Jim told me kindly. "Piegan. The blood and the Siksika are Blackfoot."
I knew that. It just hadn't tripped off my tongue.
"What were you doing out here? It's an odd place to be running around at this time of night."
Jim didn't say naked. He didn't have to.
"Boy," he said abruptly to Calvin, "don't you make your mother ashamed of her son."
The young man's mouth tightened, but he looked away from me. A few years ago, his regard wouldn't have bothered me the way it did now. But things had happened since that made me uncomfortable standing nearly naked with four strangers, five if I counted Benny, which I didn't. "I just got married," I told him, reminding my too jittery self that Adam would be on his way back by now. If something happened, and I had no reason to think it would, especially as they had handed over a blanket to cover me without a word, Adam would be here before anything too bad happened. I wouldn't be caught in the trap of assuming all men were bad, but I wouldn't have been human if I weren't wary. "We were swimming."
"Good thing for Benny," said Jim. "We've been by here twice. It would have been morning before we could have seen that boat under the trees, and morning would have been too late for him."
Fred, I could tell because he wore a red flannel shirt and Hank wore a gray one, left Benny to his brother and came over. Evidently he'd been listening because he said,
"I called 911, Jim, and they had already gotten a call from her husband. There is an ambulance on its way. I told the operator that we could get Benny up to the road. It'll be a rough trip. The road's only a half mile or so as the crow flies, but this is horrible country for a fast trek in the dark. But they'd have to make the trip twice that we need to make once." "What about taking him on the boat?" asked Calvin.
Fred shook his head.
"We might get him to the hospital faster that way, but the ambulance will have medical personnel on board. He'll get faster medical care, and time matters. If he stays in shock, we could lose him. But when he warms up, that foot is going to bleed like a fountain." "Whatever you and Hank think best," said Jim,
which seemed to make the decision for everyone. Chapter 5. The only brush or trees in this part of the gorge that weren't cultivated, very little of the ground on either side of the river was cultivated, were right on the river. For the most part, our footing was cheek grass-covered basalt, not horrible hiking if I'd had shoes. It would have been better if I could have shifted into coyote, but I didn't know these men, and I don't make it a habit of telling everyone what I am. Too many bad things happened to people who admitted too openly what they were without a powerful group behind them, and sometimes even with a powerful group behind them. I'd survived a long time by keeping my head down and blending in. I wasn't going to change that just to make my bare feet feel better. The Owens brothers and Calvin took turns carrying Benny. Jim led the way and carried a couple of flares to flag down the ambulance with. We all, except for whoever was carrying Benny, carried flashlights, which did a fair bit to destroy my night vision. I brought up the rear, though they had all suggested I stay down by the river. I could have done that, but what if they ran into Adam? Under normal circumstances, they'd be perfectly safe. But Adam had to make two fast changes tonight and experienced a number of stressors. He'd been forced to leave me naked and vulnerable. Benny had been so afraid, in addition to all the blood and pain. Adam was not human and hadn't been for a long time. His control was very good, but this was not a good night for him to be meeting up with strangers carrying a bleeding, hurt man. So I insisted on going with them. We might have been a half mile from the road, but that half mile was all up the side of a very steep hill that was broken up with basalt cliffs that ranged from 2 feet to 20 or 30 feet high. The first kind we scrambled over, the second we worked our way around. We'd made it about halfway by my hazy reckoning when Adam caught up to us. He was human and clothed, but his eyes were yellow bright from the adrenaline and the pain of his rush changes. He handed me a backpack and said,
"Clothes, shoes, and first aid."
His voice was a low growling sound, and his hand shook. "Thank you," I said. "I'm safe with them." I found that I believe that now, and it was a relief. "Can you get Benny up to the road to wait for the ambulance?" It would be dangerous, all that blood. But the men were tiring, and tired people make missteps. Adam didn't look directly at any of the strangers, so they wouldn't have the opportunity to meet his eyes. That was good and bad. It told me he was still in control, but he didn't trust himself to stay that way. He took Benny off Hank's back without a word, cradling the wounded man like a baby, which kept Benny's foot up higher, though it was a much more difficult way to carry an unconscious person than the fireman's carry the Owens brothers had been using. Hank didn't fight at him, just held very still, as though he sensed how much danger he was in. Adam lifted his head once, then took a quick look at all the men before sprinting off for the road at a dead run.
"Who the hell was that?" asked Calvin.
He had to have had a fair idea of who it was. After all, Adam had brought clothes for me. What he meant, I thought, was how did Adam run up the side of the canyon carrying Benny at a speed that would have done credit to an Olympic sprinter? "That was my husband," I said nonchalantly to the adrenaline-filled air as I opened the backpack and pulled out my jeans. "He's a werewolf, and Hank was smart enough not to make an issue of handing Benny off to him." Adam's status was not a secret, though there were still a lot of werewolves who hid what they were. Adam was almost a celebrity in the Tri-Cities, though we were hoping the fascination with him would die down. It did no harm for Calvin and the others to know what he was, and maybe it would give them a little caution when we caught up to him. Putting on my jeans was slow work because I was still a little damp, but the warmth felt wonderful. He'd packed a sweatshirt that smelled like Adam, came down to my knees, and was warmer than anything I'd brought. I dusted off my sore and bleeding feet and stuffed them into a pair of socks, then into my tennis shoes. Heaven. I looked up to see all four men watching me. "Don't meet his eyes if you can help it. He's had a rough day," I told them. Then, with the blanket in one hand, I took off after Adam, leaving the others to follow however they would. They'd been swift and sure in the face of their friend's trouble. They'd recover from the werewolf pretty fast. Adam was waiting for us at the highway shoulder when I found him. He'd set the injured man down a few yards away, where there was a big rock he'd used to keep Benny's leg elevated. "Hey." I spread the blanket over Benny and tucked it in around him. "How are you doing, Adam?"
"Not good," he admitted without looking at me. "I need someone to kill."
I think he was trying to be funny, but it came out seriously. I could hear the others approaching. My feet were battered, shoes or no shoes, and my calf ached where the water plant had been pulled off so abruptly. I hadn't made the best time up to the highway, and without Benny slowing them down, evidently they had been able to speed up a lot. I stood up and walked to Adam. "No one here needs killing," I told him with quiet urgency. "These men were out looking for Benny here. They are the good guys, so you can't kill them." Adam still wasn't meeting my eyes, but he laughed, and it sounded genuinely amused.
"Shouldn't."
"Shouldn't what?"
"Shouldn't kill them, Mercy. Not can't."
I put my forehead against his shoulder. "It's the same thing for you," I told him confidently. He took a deep breath and turned around to meet the four men who were approaching us a little warily, because they weren't stupid.
"Hello," he said,
his voice still growly and about a half octave lower than usual.
"I'm Adam Hauptmann, Alpha of the Columbia Basin Pack." "Jim Alvin," said Jim, stepping forward.
I told them not to meet his eyes, but he did better than that. Maybe it was luck, maybe he knew something of werewolves or just wild animals, but he turned one shoulder forward and tipped his head sideways and down submissively even as he reached out a hand.
"Of the Yakima Nation. Thank you for the help. Benny's a good man."
I noticed that Adam didn't get the elaboration of tribal bloodlines that I had.
Do you know what happened to him? Asked Adam after giving Jim's hand a brief shake. His eyes were wolf-bright, ominous yellow in the illumination of their flashlights.
No idea at all, Jim said.
Fred Owen stepped up. His head was lowered, too, but he was looking up into Adam's face.
I've seen all kinds of kills. A bear might bite off half a man's foot the way Benny's was. A bear, or some other big carnivore.
It was a challenge of a sort, and I held my breath. The tension dropped from Adam's shoulders, and he suddenly grinned.
You think I bit off his foot? Hell, Marine, I just got married. I have more important things to do.
Barracuda, said Hank into the sudden silence. It looks like a barracuda, or maybe a tiger shark. They have these odd teeth that they saw back and forth.
The Columbia, said Jim slowly, is freshwater.
Tiger sharks have been found up freshwater ways, Hank persisted.
Not up past dams, said Fred. How did you know I was a Marine?
Adam's eyes were now honey brown, not quite his usual bitter chocolate, but safer than before.
Easier than spotting a cop, said Adam. Might as well have it tattooed across your forehead.
He paused for effect, then said,
It helps that you're still wearing your dog tags.
You're not a Marine.
Adam shook his head.
Army Ranger. I never could swim, and since I became a werewolf, I'm all but useless in the water.
Could his foot have gotten caught by one of those old jaw traps?
Asked Calvin, speaking up for the first time. It looks sort of like that to me.
I haven't seen one of those things being used since I was a kid, Jim said, and it was illegal then. But he's right, it could do that sort of damage.
A bear trap wouldn't catch two people, Hank said.
Adam might have won over Fred with his military fellowship, but the other Owens brother was still suspicious.
Where is Faith?
He was afraid of something. I frowned at the unconscious man. Really afraid, but it wasn't Adam.
Fred nodded abruptly at his brother.
No ranger would be dumb enough to leave a witness alive.
Apparently he felt that left Adam in the clear. Hank looked less certain and rubbed a hand along his ribs as if they hurt. Maybe he had strained something carrying Benny up the hill, or maybe it was a reflex thing. About that time the ambulance, followed by a sheriff's car, pulled up. With practiced speed, the EMT people slipped Benny onto a gurney, and the ambulance roared off to the nearest hospital. The officer took down names and statements. He seemed to know the other men, and from their body language they all got along pretty well. When Fred told him Adam was a werewolf, the officer tensed up and ran his flashlight over us. His gaze brushed by me, then stopped.
"You're bleeding," he told me.
He aimed his flashlight at my leg, and damned if he wasn't right. I pulled up my pant leg. It had been so cold, and my feet had taken such a battering I hadn't really been paying attention. It hurt, but I hadn't connected that to actual damage, and there was quite a lot, really. Something had ripped the skin off my calf and taken some meat with it. It looked like a really nasty rope burn. "I got caught up in some weeds wading out to Benny's boat," I said. "Benny hit the motor while I was holding on to the boat and pulled me loose."
"That doesn't look like something a weed would do," Fred told me, shining his flashlight on it. "Some of those underwater plants can be sharp and slice you up some, but that looks more like you pulled free of a hemp rope."
"All sorts of garbage in that river," said the deputy. "Lucky you didn't get caught up in deeper water. Ambulance is in use, but I could run you to the hospital."
"No," I said. "It's nasty, but I'm up to date on my shots. Mostly it just needs cleaning and bandaging, and we have the stuff to do that." Adam had knelt to get a good look. I heard him take a deep breath, then move closer. After a minute, he shook his head and stood up.
"Thought I smelled something odd, but there's no telling what a rope might gather sitting in the river."
The deputy swallowed, having been reminded what Adam was.
"You four can take your boat back? Okay, leave Benny's boat there, and we'll get people to check it out and see what that tells us. Mostly we'll just have to wait until Benny can tell us what happened to Faith and his foot. At this point, I expected some sort of accident."
"I saw a man attacked by a barracuda once," said Adam.
He looked at Hank.
"I agree. It looked a lot like your Benny's foot."
He glanced at Calvin.
"Not a metal trap. Those old jaw traps are built to dig in and hold the animal, not go all the way through the bone. A bear trap might crush a foot off, and there was something crushing on Benny's foot, but mostly it was sliced. Something with sharp teeth went after him."
No barracuda in the Columbia, said Fred, but he didn't sound like he was arguing. No sharks either, for that matter. It looks to me like something a piece of farm machinery might do, but I've never run into a baler or harvester in the river.
My leg, once I'd noticed it, began to itch. It looked as though it ought to hurt more than it did, but right now, it itched. Maybe I'd gotten into some nettles or something while I was running around bare-legged. Adam glanced at me.
I need to get Mercy to camp.
The deputy said,
You guys go get your boat and go home. Mr. Hauptmann, I can take you and your wife back to your camp so you can take care of her.
He was scared of Adam. When we got in the car, the scent of his fear filled the air. I don't think a human would have noticed, though, and a little bit of fear wouldn't set Adam off. Adam had a lot of experience dealing with scared people. By the time we reached the campground, the deputy was deep in a discussion about what the impact of a second campground in the Maryhill area would be.
What we really need here is a good restaurant or two.
The deputy's voice carried his conviction.
The museum has a nice deli, and there are a couple of places in Biggs, but they are always overflowing with highway traffic. You have to drive all the way to Goldendale, the Dalles, or Hood River for really good food. Those are too hard to find for the tourist business pulled in by the museum or Stonehenge. I figure we lose a lot of business because we don't have enough places to eat.
He pulled up to the gates and let us out.
I'd appreciate it if you folks stayed around here for a few days in case we need to ask you anything else.
We were planning to, said Adam, but if you need us, you have my cell.
He drove off, and I told Adam, You'd better not let Brand see how diplomatic and reassuring you can be when you want. He'll make you go around the country and make speeches about how werewolves are gentle and not scary at all, too. Adam smiled and picked me up.
Shh, he said.
I didn't argue. The itching hadn't gone away, but the pain had increased just on the short ride to the camp. Besides, carrying me wasn't much of an effort for a werewolf. Hey, I said, you've been playing the hero pack mule all day, first Robert, then Benny, and now me. He set me down in front of the trailer and opened the door for me. When I sat down on the leather sofa, he turned on the interior lights and rolled my pant leg up to my knee. In the bright light of the trailer, it looked a lot worse than it had. Yellow stuff and blood crusted the cut, which was about an inch wide and deeper than I'd thought. The first hint of bruising was beginning to show up above and below the cut, and the edges had puffed up. Adam put his nose down to my leg and sniffed again. He took a fluffy towel out of a cupboard and put that over his leg. Then he propped my calf on his thigh and poured liquid fire over the cut. I know some people claim that hydrogen peroxide doesn't hurt. Goody for them. I hate this stuff. I jumped when the hydrogen peroxide hid and shrank down into the couch as it continued to bubble ferociously. Adam used the damp towel to clean my leg, then he sniffed again.
That was no rope, he growled. There was something caustic or poisonous on whatever grabbed you. I can smell it.
Is that why it itches? I asked.
Probably.
He handed me a couple of pills from a bottle in the kit. What is this?
Antihistamine, he said, in case the swelling is an allergic reaction.
If I take these, I'll be asleep in 3 minutes. I took them anyway. The need to dig my fingers into that cut and scratch was almost unbearable as soon as the burn of the hydrogen peroxide had worn off. We need to call Uncle Mike, I said in a small voice. I didn't want to start an argument again. He must have heard it in my voice because he patted my knee.
I'll call as soon as I'm through here. But I doubt that Uncle Mike sent us here for this.
Just to be clear, I said, I didn't misunderstand you, right? You and the Owenses are thinking that there is some kind of fish that ate Benny's foot.
Too soon to make assumptions, said Adam. Maybe they stopped on shore for lunch and met a bear.
Are there even bear around here?
Probably not here, Adam acknowledged, but up where we were hiking there are. No telling how far Benny got his boat from the initial attack.
So what was it that grabbed my leg? I asked.
That is something that Uncle Mike might know, Adam said. How much of those otters did you see?
I blinked, my brain already starting to haze from the antihistamine. Otters. I sat up a little straighter. Those weren't river otters. Their heads were a little differently shaped. I hadn't paid much attention to that at the time. Adam nodded.
I saw one when I got back to the boat. What do you bet that there are European species? Werewolves aren't the only shapeshifters in Europe.
I've heard of selkies and kelpies, I said, but not shape-shifting otters.
Nor have I, said Adam, frowning at my calf. But selkies interacted with people a lot. Kelpies are rarer, I'm told, but terrifying. You can see why there would be stories about them. Otters just aren't scary.
So speaks the man who hadn't been naked in the river with them. They may be small, but they are agile and mean. There was a knock on the door, and Adam and I both stared at it in shock. The gate by the highway was shut, and it wasn't so far from the trailer that we wouldn't have heard someone stopping there. He glanced at me, and I shook my head. I hadn't heard anyone coming either. Adam reached into his luggage, quietly pulled out a handgun, and tucked it into the back of his jeans, tugging his shirt down over it. The quiet knock came again.
"Who is it?" asked Adam. "I am Gordon Seeker, Calvin's grandfather, Mr. Hauptmann. He said that your wife got hurt helping Benny, who is a young friend of mine."
Adam opened the door warily. He stepped back, and I saw the old man at the door for the first time. His voice hadn't sounded old, but I didn't think I'd ever seen anyone older outside a rest home. Sharp brown eyes peered at me out of a face that looked as though it had been left out in the sun to dry too long. Skin like beef jerky, and white hair caught back in a smooth French braid down his back. He wore horn-rimmed glasses and small gold studs in his ears. His back was bent, and his hands were curled up from arthritis, his fingers bent and knuckles enlarged. But his movements were surprisingly easy as he climbed into the trailer without invitation. He wore jeans and a plain red T-shirt under a Redskins jacket. I'm not sure if he was a football fan, if he wore it as a statement, or if it was just something to keep out the cool night air. Over his shoulder, he carried one of those leather bags that should look like a purse but doesn't. On his feet were the most lurid pair of cowboy boots I've ever seen, and that is saying something because I come from cowboy country and cowboys wear some really gaudy stuff. The boots were bright lipstick red, each with a United States flag beaded in red, white, and blue across the top. He smelled of fresh air and tobacco, but his tobacco hadn't come out of a cigarette. A pipe, maybe, something without all the additives that make cigarettes smell so bad. It reminded me of my father's ghost.
"He told me about you, Mr. Hauptmann," said Calvin's grandfather. "Been a long time since I saw a werewolf. Not a lot of them in this part of the country. And this must be your wife, Mercedes."
Then he looked at me and drew in a breath.
"You," he said. "I wasn't expecting you. Calvin said you were Blackfeet married to an Anglo werewolf. I should have asked myself how many Blackfeet women would associate with a werewolf, shouldn't I? I had wondered what happened to you."
He narrowed his eyes.
"You don't look like Old Coyote. Oh, I can see him some in your eyes and in your coloring. But you look more Anglo than I expected."
He had known my father. Suddenly, antihistamine or no antihistamine, I wasn't at all sleepy. But there was a disconnect between my tongue and the questions that were galloping through my head. I looked at Adam. His eyes were half-lidded, and his expression was neutral. His body language said, "Isn't he interesting? Let's see what he does." The old man looked down at my leg and hissed.
"That looks bad. River Devil is back for sure."
He sat beside me and opened the purse that wasn't a purse, and pulled out a bundle wrapped in a silk scarf. He opened it up and began singing. If you've never heard Native American music, it is hard to convey the feel of it. Sometimes there are words, but Gordon Seeker didn't use any. The music flowed up from his chest and resonated in his sinuses, as had the music made by the dancing ghost of my father. Still singing, Gordon Seeker took out a homemade honeycomb wax candle and lit it. It looked as though he lit it with magic, but I can usually sense when someone uses magic. I didn't see a match, though I could smell sulfur. I sniffed suspiciously, and he grinned at me, and I noticed he was missing one of his front teeth. Still singing, he held up his empty hand and closed his fingers. Then he opened the hand, and he held a burnt matchstick.
Then he pulled a segment of leaf out and held it to the candle. It was dry and lit fast. He let it go, and I tensed to grab it before it burned the trailer. But the flames consumed the leaf before it hit the carpet, leaving only a smattering of ash and a surprising amount of smoke. I recognized the plant by its smell when I hadn't recognized